Progressive Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. This is Carolyn Yeager. I don't have a guest tonight because I want to talk to you in a serious, heartfelt way about the Holocaust. Why it is the most vital and also vulnerable issue facing us today, and why it therefore cannot be abandoned or ignored. When I say it is vital, I mean that it's nothing less than the survival of white European men and women as free, self-governing beings that depends upon the removal of the Holocaust hoax from our or the historical record. Even if it were only removed from our historical record, that would be sufficient because it is our belief in it that is the problem. I know that many who are listening to me do not believe in the narrative of the Holocaust, or believe they do not believe in it, but a surprising number probably do believe in it, if only partially. Partial belief is the most common stance for the white nationalists, or as John DeNugent likes to call it, white nationist. That's not a bad term. When someone says, "I don't deny the Holocaust altogether," they are stating that they believe in the Holocaust. Even if they have reservations or doubts about certain details, or even whole areas of the officially sanctioned account. If they accept the word Holocaust, by accepting or acquiescing to the word itself, they indicate a belief that something truly awful and unique took place. Because Holocaust is a very strong word, and the Holocaust means it's a one-time and highly important event. That's why I like the term holo, and I'm starting to use that more. You know, my guest of a couple weeks ago, Gunter Deckard, coined that word some years back, and he didn't even get arrested for it, and that was in Germany. Think of that. Obviously, it's perfectly okay to use that term. Many of our supposedly awake people also believe that to question some parts of the Holocaust is sufficient and is really the best way to go because it is reasonable, while attacking too much of the Holocaust will make you appear unreasonable and thus turn people against you. But in practice, it seems to me that questioning part of the Holocaust will get you in just as much trouble with the hardcore defenders as questioning all of it. There's another aspect to this I might call unconscious belief. Many people might want to question or deny the holo, but find themselves unable to break from the traditional or common thinking they've been a part of for so long. There's also this idea that something that so many people believe in can't be all wrong. It's very hard to really break from what the majority of people are thinking. I can hear some people questioning me right now, so I might ask here, what constitutes partial questioning? The most common is simply to question the number of 6 million victims. This is pretty safe because a number of holo historians, not revisionists, have given lesser numbers, but not too much less. Another often heard question is to deny the gas chambers, but nothing else. This means that a lot of people, including lots of Jews, were purposely killed, but by means other than gas in specially designed rooms. Some go much farther and say that no one was purposely killed at all, but the Nazi practice of throwing people willy-nilly into concentration camps, making them work too hard and too long of hours, and not feeding them sufficiently, caused innocent people to die. And here's another area that keeps people chained to basic Holocaust belief. This is a hatred for the Nazis, as the members of the National Socialist ruling party in Germany at the time were derogatorily called. Many of our people who identify most closely with one of Germany's neighboring nations, or with the nations that were at war with Germany at the time, feel unable or unwilling to release the Nazis from responsibility for this unique atrocity. It is terribly convenient to have something like the Holo to make your own wrongdoing fade in comparison. So these are some of the reasons for ambivalence about this issue. Another problem we have is that many of our writers and scholars who like to know what they're talking about before they talk about it, which is a good thing, are not knowledgeable enough about it. And when you're not knowledgeable about the research that's been done into the Holo, you tend to go along with the official story because it's familiar to you and because you're not able to personally refute it. There's nothing like studying research into the Holo to turn one into a revisionist. That's the truth, and that is how revisionism has grown. You might ask, why then don't Holocaust scholars become revisionists? The answer might surprise you. Because they are not studying and researching into the Holo to find the truth of the matter, but in order to find explanations for preconceived conclusions. And many don't even study and research it at all. They just follow what the Nuremberg trials concluded and what other writers before them have said, who put full credence into witness testimonies and forged documents, and don't seek for any forensic or documentary proof. In other words, the whole thing is a scam, including the historians. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about the people who continue to believe in it and why. I think I need to say some words now about why I think it is the most vital issue of our time. The current world order, which is the global new world order, is based on the outcome of World War II and the lessons of the Holocaust story. Public attitudes have been shaped by the dictates of the victors of World War II, and our moral, religious obligations have been defined by the so-called lessons of the Holocaust. The main lesson of the Holocaust, as the world understands it and as we are taught it, is that racial thinking leads to genocide. These public attitudes are anti-white, anti-racialist, anti-nationalist, anti-merit-based societies, anti-traditional Christianity, anti-everything that would allow us to remain as we are and to have a voice. I think most of you are familiar with Paul Craig Roberts. If not, he's a man who was once an establishment figure, but who evolved in his retirement into something of an anti-establishment writer, and he recently published a goodbye column about a little over a week ago. And many people have been followers of him and admirers of Roberts, and I'm going to read a quote from this goodbye column, in which he said he was not going to be writing any longer because truth was seen as anything valuable in our society. So quoting, he says, America's fate was sealed when the public... Now, the reason I'm quoting this is because he's talking about 9/11. But after I read his quote, I'm going to paraphrase what he said and substitute the Holocaust for 9/11. Because the two have very much in common and can often be thought of something in tandem. So now quoting from Paul Craig Roberts... America's fate was sealed when the public and the anti-war movement bought the government's 9/11 conspiracy theory. The government's account of 9/11 is contradicted by much evidence. Nevertheless, this defining event of our time, which has launched the U.S. on interminable wars of aggression and a domestic police state, is a taboo topic for investigation in the media. Then he says, it is pointless to complain of war and a police state when one accepts the premise upon which they are based, which is the official story of 9/11. Now, I'm going to put this in my own words here, change it a little bit, and I say it thus. The white Europeans' fate was sealed when they bought the Allied version of World War II including the reality of the concentration camps and the fate of the Jews as depicted during the several international military trials. This Allied account of World War II, and most especially what is called the Holocaust, is contradicted by much evidence. Nevertheless, this defining event of our time, which has launched the free world, in quotes, led by the USA, on interminable wars of aggression, domestic police states, unlimited non-white immigration into white countries, is a taboo topic for investigation in the media. It is pointless to complain of war, police states, and the loss of white majorities when one accepts the premise upon which they are based. You think the Holocaust has nothing to do with immigration policies? Think again. You think the Holocaust has nothing to do with white disaffection from their own race, just as it was used to bring about Germany's disaffection from their own history and national pride? Think again. It is all connected. I want to tell you now how I see the Holocaust. I see it as a huge monster made up of lies, added to lies, adding more lies, until there exists this giant thing sitting in the heart of Europe, poisoning greater Europeans against each other. Until this monstrous creature is utterly destroyed and the truth, the facts of what really happened are revealed, no progress can be made in opening the common people's thinking to racial realities. For lack of a better term, I use the term racial realities. The lesson of the Holocaust, as I said already, and as it is taught in Holo studies, is that racial thinking leads to genocide. And unfortunately, Israel, in its actual slow genocide of Palestinians, is making that appear to be true every day. Israel is not doing us any favor in showing itself to be a genocidal, racist regime. But back to this monstrous creature called Holo. Images of St. George slaying the dragon come to mind. This is a favorite image of mine, and it was painted by many famous artists during the period of Christian art. Some famous St. George paintings are done by Raphael, Peter Paul Rubens, and Roger van der Weyden has a well-known painting in our own National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. In these paintings, as I looked over them again, my own memory of them sort of changes from what they actually are. And as I looked at them, I see that this ugly, vile-looking reptilian creature, which is the dragon, is rather small. And St. George seems to very easily, sitting astride his white horse, he appears in total control of the situation as he skillfully plunges his spear or sword into this beast's body as it writhes down on the ground. As I said, this memory of this dragon in these paintings grew to a much larger size in my own mind, and what I came to see is a large and bloated, very repulsive creature. And George was plunging his spear right into the belly of this horrible beast. When I think of the Holo now, I see something like this, and I have for some time. And I think we need to do something exactly like what St. George is doing. And by this I mean, we need to kill this thing dead. I'm going to tell you a little story here from the Golden Legend. It's a collection of medieval tales, and it tells the story of St. George and the dragon. And in this Golden Legend version, the event took place in a town named Selene or Silene. The town had a pond as large as a lake where a plague-bearing dragon dwelled that envenomed all the countryside. To appease the dragon, the people of Silene used to feed it a sheep every day. And when the sheep failed, they fed it their children, chosen by lottery. It happened that the lot fell on the king's daughter. The king, distraught with grief, told the people they could have all his gold and silver and half of his kingdom if his daughter were spared. But the people refused. The daughter was sent out to the lake, decked out as a bride, to be fed to the dragon, because the people feared this dragon very, very much. St. George, by chance, rode past the lake at this time. The princess, trembling, sought to send him away, but George vowed to remain. The dragon reared out of the lake to see if the girl was all right while they were conversing. St. George fortified himself with the sign of the cross, charged it on horseback with his lance, and gave it a grievous wound. Then he called to the princess to throw him her girdle, or sash, and he put it around the dragon's neck. When she did so, the dragon followed the girl like a meek beast on a leash. The dragon thought that St. George was going to hurt the girl, so he followed her back into the city, where the dragon terrified the people at its approach. The king and the people of Cyllene converted to Christianity at this point. George slew the dragon, and the body was carted out of the city on 4 ox carts. And then it goes on to say, sort of strangely, that 15,000 men were baptized without women and children, whatever that means. On the site where the dragon died, the king built a church to the Blessed Virgin Mary and to St. George. And from its altar, a spring arose whose waters cured all disease. Well, I want you to notice that even though in this fable the dragon appeared to become meek for a while, George still slew it, and they carted it off. He didn't decide, nor did the people, that maybe the dragon was going to be nicer now, so maybe it could stay around and they would all get along together. No, the dragon was an alien element and would always be a completely alien element in the community. And this is exactly what we need to do with this hollow monster. How can we allow it to live, continuing its destructive ways, plundering and exploiting and demanding tribute from the European and European-derived nations? How can anyone think that we can ignore this monstrosity, this hideous beast, and still save Europe, America, and European values while it still exists, while the holo still exists? But when we consider what the difficulties are, we find that apart from the Jews, who may seem to be mostly responsible for the holo, there are others. We find that we run into a problem with nationalism, with the nationalism of some peoples being opposed to the nationalism of others. Or, more accurately, they are very concerned with how their favorite or chosen ethnic nationality is portrayed in the historical record. You know, this is very understandable. I understand. But I think it's something we have to face and deal with, or we'll never get rid of this monster that should be seen as an enemy of all of us. But today it's not seen that way. For example, a current Russian World War II revisionist article was posted in the UK Telegraph newspaper on February 26th, and it was written by a Russian historian, and it reflects the decision that Russia has made to emphasize the positive value of Stalin's reign, which means they want to show Stalin's contribution to winning World War II for the Allies, and put the emphasis on that rather than on the murderous side of Stalin's reign. And for that purpose, this historian writes things like this. I'm going to quote a couple of sentences from this article, which was actually written for a magazine in Russia. He writes, this historian, "The Second World War was no ordinary war. It was possibly the only war in history that was fought against absolute evil, a fight that united idealists defending their ideals, cynics defending their interests, and even scoundrels trying to incinerate their sins in the flames of a great struggle." Notice that they are this constant effort to portray the National Socialists as absolute evil. So anything and everything that was done about them, even until today, is justified. And he justifies these murderous communists in the Soviet Union by calling them simply cynics and scoundrels. You know, upgrading their standing. Another quote from this article: "The difference between communism and Nazism is, the communist scoundrels understood who they were because they realized the gulf separating them from the ideals they revered. But the Nazis liked being scoundrels. That was their ideal. And this is written by a historian. So this is what is happening. This is what happens to our history as historians are being used by states to create their own mythologies. In connection with this, Russian nationalists in Crimea in mid-March burned Ukrainian history textbooks to protest what they say are distortions of the past by the administration of former President Viktor Yushchenko. In the port city of Sevastopol, they threw Ukrainian history textbooks into boxes at the foot of a local monument to Russian Empress Catherine the Great. The books were to be turned into pulp. More history textbooks were burned the following day at another demonstration in Simferopol, the capital of Crimea. Among the participants were members of the pro-Russian and far-left Progressive Socialist Party of Ukraine. They said they agreed that burning books was wrong, but in this case it was justified because, in their opinion, the books promoted fascism in Ukraine. They will continue to burn and trample the books, they say, and perhaps even make toilet paper out of them. What do they object to in these books? Exactly this, that they didn't condemn or they don't condemn Ukrainians who fought against Russian or Soviet imperial rule, that they didn't condemn or condemn enough all pro-Nazis. Pro-Russian forces also resent Mr. Yushchenko's campaign to teach the Ukrainian language to school children in Russian-speaking regions of the country. Wow, they don't want the teaching of Ukrainian language in Ukraine. Now, to continue about this, and of course the teaching about the Holodomor, I think that's how it's pronounced, a Kremlin-inspired famine more than 75 years ago that was aimed at collectivizing Soviet agriculture, is highly objected to. The tragedy claimed the lives of millions, but any mention of the Holodomor was strictly forbidden in the USSR. And now it is becoming forbidden again in modern Russia under Putin Medvedev. Well, this is how so-called historical narrative is developed. History is probably the most inexact discipline there is. I don't think it can be called a discipline. Protest organizers in Crimea actually say they are counting on newly elected President Viktor Yanukovych to downplay Ukrainian history and language. Ukraine's new education minister, Dmytro Tabachnik, is expected to promote pro-Russian policies. However, he's raised eyebrows with statements that suggest Western and Eastern Ukraine should be separated or should never have been united in the first place. Well, there's an idea I actually think has some merit, but then I'm not a Ukrainian nationalist. But it is true that there are fundamental differences in the makeup and thinking of Western and Eastern Ukrainians, and this seems to be another case of forcing disparate people together based on who won what war. In the Balkans, just a few days ago, a former Canadian ambassador to Yugoslavia, James Bissett, called on Croatia to publicly apologize for its alleged World War II, quote, genocide, unquote. Yes, he called it genocide. Against the Serbs and communists, and completely ignores, well, he said against the Serbs and some others, I'm putting in the word communists, and completely ignores the slaughter of pro-Nazi or simply anti-communist Croats by Tito's forces with the help of the British at the end of the war. Slovenians were included in this slaughter, and lots of Germans too, of course, but who cares about them, right? Then Mr. Bissett has the gall to say that Hitler's forces invaded Yugoslavia in the spring of 1941, when in truth the legitimate government of Yugoslavia at that time had signed on to the tripartite pact with Germany, and it was the communists, aided by the British, who overthrew that legal popular government and established their own illegal rulers. This is what caused Hitler to come to the aid of this ally and drive the invaders out. At that time, Croatia allied itself with Germany, which after the war became a crime. With all the confusion and anger among nationalists of various stripes and persuasions, and all the changes and trends in historical thinking, Still, most are quite happy for this holo monster to remain where it is because they see it as basically serving their interests, which is to cover up rather than to reveal truth. But they are going to find out that the truth is really the best policy in the end. It's important to understand that most Holocaust claims are derived from wartime anti-Nazi propaganda. I don't care what your personal views of Germany and Germans are. It is the heart of Europe, and it is the source race of much of Western Europe. Because of the Holo Monster, the German nation of today is completely abnormal. Thus, all Europe is in the same shape. Any normalization is blocked by the official recognition and/or belief that Germans were responsible for the Holocaust. This is also what makes it possible to blame Germans for starting both world wars, which is totally inaccurate, but that's a subject for another time. To have a chance of resisting the global New World Order and saving our white homelands for white people, we must destroy this monster. And there is an opportunity that we have right now to strike a strategic blow to this ravenous beast, to cause a real and painful wound that just might bring about a weakening that could lead to further blows and maybe even a fatal blow sometime down the road. I'm going to talk about this opportunity after the break, so please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
I'm here in London with William Engdahl, economist and geopolitician, to talk about the future of the Eurozone and US involvement in the crisis that's currently going on there. William Engdahl, thanks very much for talking to RT today. Now, first of all, you have a new book out, The Gods of Money.
Yeah.
Could you tell me a bit about what drove you to write that book and what its main ideas are?
The concept of the gods of money is really part of a trilogy that I've written. The first is all keyed off of a quote from Henry Kissinger when he was Secretary of State in the 1970s. Kissinger at that time said, if you control the oil, you control whole nations or groups of nations. If you control the food, you control the people. If you control the money, you control the entire world. And the research on the Gods of Money book has taken place over a period of some 25 to 30 years that I've been engaged as an economist and an economic writer, analyzing the developments in the global financial system, the dollar system in particular. And with the onset of the current global crisis in August of 2007, it became clear the results of that crisis, the way that the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Treasury, the U.S. government as a whole, the Congress, stooped over backwards to bail out the Wall Street banks that created the crisis through fraud, deception, criminal behavior, to the tune of trillions of dollars of taxpayer money. And as the chairman of Goldman Sachs, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, Blankfein, said in an interview with the London Times recently, he said, we're simply bankers doing the work of God. And that is their attitude. They see themselves as the gods of money. They're a class above mere mortals, and they can do what they wish. And that, I think, is the basic background.
We're meeting in London, which is obviously part of a Europe that's in crisis at the moment.
Yeah.
How do you view the things that are going on in the Eurozone at the moment? How bad and how systemic do you think it is?
It's a relative thing. You have to compare the crisis going on with Greece and the Eurozone and the various countries such as Portugal, Italy, and Spain in a context of a global system. The center of gravity of the global crisis is New York, is the United States, is the U.S. financial system, the dollar system, and to a secondary extent, the pound and the city of London. That was where all of the toxic waste.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I was talking about the importance of Holocaust revisionism and why it is essential to the survival of the white race. It sounds very dramatic. It sounds maybe overstated. But I do not believe it is, and I tried to make the case for why I didn't. As I told you, there is an opportunity, quite a wonderful opportunity that we have now, to make some real inroads in this area. We're back to Carlo Mantegna. On March 26, Carlo Mantegna, the well-known Holocaust revisionist, posted a new essay with some additional documents that pertain to Elie Wiesel's legitimacy as the world's most famous Holocaust survivor on the Inconvenient History Revisionist blog. These new documents add to the mystery of Elie Wiesel's true identity, but they also strengthen the case that the Wiesel was never at Auschwitz and probably was never at Buchenwald either. For me, the evidence is as tight as it needs to be. More might be forthcoming, and it wouldn't hurt, especially if we could discover just where he actually was during that time. But it's not necessary in order to indict him in the public domain, and even to bring criminal charges against him. Let me explain. It's interesting how something that appears to be a defeat can, in time, become the seed of a new victory. In 2008, Eric Hunt was on trial in California for accosting Elie Wiesel in a hotel foyer. This was a very low point for truth seekers like Eric, and a seemingly high point for Wiesel. Recently, though, Carlo Mantegna looked over the transcript of Elie Wiesel of Eric Hunt's trial, and he found this. And I'm going to read a portion of the minutes dated 8th July 2008. At the trial of the state of California versus Eric Hunt. And Elie Wiesel was on the witness stand, and he was being questioned by one of the, I don't know if this was the prosecuting attorney or the defense attorney, but it doesn't make any difference. He made the following statements under oath. First, they were asking him about his book, Night, and if it was the first book he published in English. He said yes. The first book he ever published, he said yes. And then he was asked, and is this book, Night, that you wrote a true, and, well, this is a funnily worded question, but, and is this book, Night, that you wrote a true account of your experience during World War II? And he answered, it is a true account. Every word in it is true. Can you believe that? I mean, this book was first, this is so funny, because this book was first listed as fiction for a long time, and I think it was when Oprah put it on her recommendation list that the publishers changed it to nonfiction. But in any case, at some point it was switched from fiction to nonfiction, and yet he's saying that every word is true. Then he was asked, and what day were you born in Sighet, Romania? And he answered, September 30th, 1928. Then he was asked, and what was tattooed on your left arm? And he answered, my number was A7713. My father's number was 7712. Now remember, Elie is under oath on the witness stand, so he is perjuring himself when he says he has this number tattooed on his left arm and that his father's number was 7712. There are currently a couple of photographs circulating that show Elie's left arm bare and no tattoo is seen. One is a color photograph that I saw just yesterday. It was being circulated in an email by Fritz Berg. I had never seen that one before. And there's also the one, there's another one that was in Miklos Gruner's book, which is the black and white photograph showing Ellie's arm. He's eating something. His hand is up to his mouth. And there is nothing on that can be seen on his arm. This is his left arm. But this photograph is dark. And, you know, it can be said, well, you can't really tell. It's really too dark to be conclusive. So that's the deal with Ellie's number. Among the documents that Carla has brought out is a letter dated the 15th of May, 2002, addressed to Gruner from the Buchenwald Memorial Museum. This is from their archive section, their archive department. It contains the following information, and again I'm quoting, Lazar Wiesel, born on 4th September 1913 at Zigit, or Maro Zigit, which is the same as Zigit, arrived at Buchenwald with a transport from Auschwitz, and it gives the Buchenwald archives microfilm page number and entry number and so on. And then it says, quoting again from the archives, Buchenwald for Lazar Wiesel, Buchenwald number 123565, born on 4th September 1913, and Auschwitz number A7713. And it says, these data are confirmed by the numerical file card at the camp office. So what this boils down to is that Lazar Wiesel, the real inmate at Auschwitz, was 15 years older than our Ellie. And he retained that number because he arrived at Buchenwald with it. Ellie, on the other hand, was not listed on that transport to Buchenwald, although he says he arrived at Buchenwald at the same time. There is another Buchenwald document, a questionnaire of the American military government in Germany, which concerns Lazar Wiesel. And this Lazar is spelled differently. It's spelled with two accents over the two A's, or an accent over each of the A's. And in these languages, when you put the accents, then it changes the pronunciation of the name, which makes it basically a different name, although it's spelled the same. So this Lazar, this accented Lazar Wiesel, is shown to be born on the 4th of October, 1928, which is now a fourth birth date that we have, including Ellie's birth date of September 30th, for a Lazar or Elizar Wiesel, with the ID number, or this particular accented Lazar Wiesel, is shown to have the ID number of 123165. Written on it. This is the Buchenwald ID number. This is the prisoner that was supposedly sent to Paris with a convoy of orphans in July 1945, which Ellie claims was himself. However, Ellie Wiesel has never claimed the Buchenwald ID number of 123165. He has never claimed any Buchenwald ID number. And in fact, this ID number, according to a Buchenwald archives file card, is shown to belong to a prisoner of a different name, the name of Pavel Kuhn, a Slovenian Jew, who died at Buchenwald on 8th March 1945. That is, this Pavel Kuhn is shown to have arrived from Auschwitz along at the same time that the real Wiesels arrived, Lazar and his brother Abram, and he died at Buchenwald between the time he arrived and the time the camp was liberated in April. And this, so the questionnaire filled out by the accented Lazar Wiesel with the number 123165 was filled out on April 22nd, 1945, a month and a half after the death of Pavel Kuhn. This gets more and more interesting, doesn't it? There is supposedly a birth certificate of the Romanian Central National Record Office, dated 27 November 1996, for Lazar Wiesel, born at Sighet on 6 October 1928, to Solomon Wiesel, spelled V-I-Z-E-L, and Sura Feig. But Ellie claims his birth date is 30th September, not 6th October. However, these are the names he gives to his parents. And I ask, is it possible this is yet another Lazar Weasel whose identity Ellie has also taken? It's possible he is using several people because Lazar Weasel was not an unusual name in that time and place. Weasel was not uncommon, and neither was the first name of Lazar or Eleazar. So the same documents tell us that Auschwitz prisoner number 7712, and these are all preceded by an A, was assigned to Abraham Wiesel, spelled V-I-E-Z-E-L, born on 10th October 1900, who arrived at Buchenwald on 26th January 1945 in the same transport as Lazar Weasel, the real Lazar Weasel, and died there on 2nd February. This man was Lazar Weasel's older brother, Abram. So again, the number A7712 could not have belonged to Ellie's father, whose name was Solomon, as Ellie testified under oath at Eric Hunt's trial. So from Eric Hunt's ordeal, which must have been pretty terrifying for him, as he was only 23 years old at the time, comes this perjury of Ellie Weasel. My friends, this is a gift from heaven, and we really need to make the most of this. We have here a target of opportunity, and we must strike. Ellie Weasel is called the world's most famous Holocaust survivor, and he is in our sights, and we need to do as St. George did and take him out. This is no time for sympathy. This is no time for being nice, no time for feeling sorry for people, for being understanding. This is a time for St. George to come forth. Who is our St. George? First and foremost, I say Eric Hunt. Eric dealt the first grievous wound, maybe by simply going and accosting Mr. Weasel and causing a furor around this, around him. Later, Carlo Mutonio came and slew this dragon that had been envenoming all the countryside. I would say Ellie Weasel is slain, but he's not buried, and we now need to carry his body off in the ox carts. Otherwise, the people will continue to think that nothing has changed, because as we know, the media and the official power forces in this world, including academia and our historians, will continue to treat Ellie Weasel in exactly the same way, and he will. Nobody will know that he's already been killed. So we need to do something about this. We need to let people know. Already, some talented listeners have made a video called Pop Goes the Weasel. Well, I call it that. That's not the official name of it, but it is posted at YouTube, and please keep getting more people to watch it. And those of you out there that are so talented, please continue to make more videos. And now we have some more information in an article in the Dayton News. This is this was published back on not very long ago, on March 25th. It's a story about at the University of Dayton that Ellie Weasel was there as a featured speaker at their diversity lecture series. And the article says that he's the world's most widely known Holocaust survivor. And he met with the press, high school and college students, and 2,300 members of the local community while he was there. And during this meeting, he was asked questions, of course, and what he thinks is the biggest problem today. And he said, today I'm bothered by the resurgence among the extreme right in our country. Some people call our president Hitler. My God. So for Ellie Weasel, the big problem that we all need to be looking at is the resurgence of the right. A student asked him if he still has his concentration camp number and if it serves him as a reminder of his terrible experiences. And Ellie said, I quote, I don't need that to remember. I think about my past every day. But I still have it on my arm, A7713. At that time, we were numbers, no names, no identity. Ha, he wishes there was no identity, but there was. And it's finding him out. He also was asked what he would say to a Holocaust denier, and he said he would say nothing. Again, I quote him, he said, I don't want to be in the same room with a Holocaust denier. They are morally deranged. Now, morally deranged, boy, you know, if anybody is morally deranged, it is Elie Wiesel. And so, you know, he deals in pure projection of this man. You just look at him and you see that he's morally deranged, but you can see it in his pictures. He used to be a fairly decent-looking guy when he was younger, but the older he gets and the more he has spent his life in this moral derangement and all of his lies, the more morally deranged his appearance becomes. Okay, now on to the most important things is that we have two visits of Elie Wiesel to university campuses coming up in April. And I am proposing that some good people organize to go to these campuses and demonstrate against Elie Wiesel with all of this information that we now have, that he is an imposter and that he is a perjurer and that there are documents, and to use Miklos Gruner as the source of this rather than Carlo Matonio, because if we start bringing up Carlo Matonio in situations like this, then they will just say, well, he's a denier, and so what does he know? But we can use Miklos Gruner's, because he is the true source of this information, and he's the one who's originally charging Elie Wiesel with being an imposter. And he is a Holocaust survivor himself, who is actually documented for being in both Auschwitz and Buchenwald. So the first is 1 week from today, friends. 1 week from today, on Monday, April 12th, Elie Wiesel is going to speak on the Vanderbilt campus in Nashville, Tennessee, and as part of a Project Dialogue series, which is the source of this was Gary White, who is the interim director of religious life. But Wiesel is going to speak at 7 p.m. on April 12th in Langford Auditorium. That's next Monday night. And I think people from Nashville, Tennessee, need to get some friends and organize, or people from anywhere in that area. I have already sent an email to James Edwards, but he lives in Memphis, but to see if they could help to get some people enthused and organized to go out there with signs and flyers and demonstrate with the truth about Elie Wiesel while he's there. And also, of course, very much try to get news coverage of this in a positive way. The next university that Elie is going to be visiting is Chapman University in Orange County, California. And we have a lot of people in Southern California. This is less than 3 weeks from today. It's going to take place on Sunday and Monday, September 30th. No, that's the day of them. Excuse me. Sunday and Monday, April 25th, 26th. He is going to be at Chapman University to participate in a fundraising event marking the 10th anniversary of Chapman's Rogers Center for Holocaust Education and their Stern Chair in Holocaust Education. This Chapman University must be something. It's all about the Holocaust. It has to be one of these Jewish schools that crop up, because they, you know, fund them, and then they have put all this focus on Jewish studies and Holocaust studies. This university even has a Holocaust Memorial Library, and they have, in 2005, they unveiled a large bronze bust of Elie Wiesel near the entrance of their Holocaust Memorial Library. Can you imagine? This place is something. Anyway, he was there in 2005 to mark the 60th anniversary of his release from the Buchenwald concentration camp, where he probably never was at any time. But now he's going to be there celebrating their Rogers. I think it will be at the Rogers Center for Holocaust Education, but I can't say for sure. And while he's there, he's also going to be speaking to While he's speaking to Chapman University students, he's also going to be speaking to middle and high school students who submitted winning entries in the 11th Annual Holocaust Art and Writing Contest, sponsored by Chapman and the 1939 Club, which is a Holocaust survivor organization. So this university is heavily, heavily into Holocaust promotion. And if those who can organize and go down there and demonstrate have to be careful not to alert this university in advance, because they will most definitely find ways to keep you out. So, you know, you have to show up. But the other thing that's important is that you don't project yourself as deniers or as being against the Holocaust, but you just project yourself as wanting to tell the truth about Elie Wiesel. I would suggest signs like Elie Wiesel, just another Holocaust imposter, or Elie, show us your tattoo, or imposter and perjurer, or Elie Wiesel was never at Auschwitz or Buchenwald, or Elie Wiesel lied under oath, or Elie Wiesel, stolen identity. Stolen identity is the title of Miklos Gruner's book. He also calls himself now Michael Gruner when he writes in English, when he puts his things in English. So, the connection should be, as I said above, to Michael Gruner and his book, Stolen Identity, and all the documents that he provided. And what Carlo has done, he's added some documents, and certainly added this part from the Eric Hunt trial. But he's also organized it in a way that we can follow it and understand it, because Miklos Gruner's book, I have a photocopied copy of it, is pretty confusing and a little bit nutso itself. But his charges are correct, and he's very serious about it, and he's very angry about it. And so, he is the one who should be referred to. And the fact that there are documents that it's proven, and that Elie needs to show his tattoo, and Elie needs to answer these questions, is what should be focused on. And how you will deal with the press and alerting the press and not alerting Chapman University too much, I do not know. But you're all people who know how to go about all that. So I hope that there will be a large group from Southern California that will converge on Chapman University on April 25th and 26th to carry out this very important objective of alerting the world and making a big issue out of this Elie Wiesel imposter business. And I want to say that if any of you who will agree to do this, if you need any money to help pay for printing costs or other costs, please write to me via reasonradio.com, and I'm willing to help you. I'm willing to send a donation. And if anyone is organizing, let us know at reasonradio.com, and maybe just put it in the comment section, and then you can be answered there. And let's take advantage of this fantastic opportunity that has been given to us, because this is a thread that can be pulled that might just begin an unraveling of many, many other things to do with this horrible beast that's been envenoming us and been poisoning our people for 60 years, 65 years now, 70 years maybe. So I thank you for listening tonight. I hope I'll be getting some feedback from some people out there. I appreciate your support of my program, and I look forward to talking with you again next week. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.